You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
From our studio to yours, this is Various Artists.
Ahiahi marie, tēnā koutou kato, ko mea toko ingoa.
Ko se whia tōku ingoa, nau mai, haere mai ki Various Artists mō tēnei wiki. Kia ora mea, how are you today?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm good, I've had a bit of a hectic week, but yeah. I feel like can have a chill weekend now. Excited Yay. To talk about some art.
Yeah, beautiful.
Do a bit of that. What have we got on the show today?
Yeah, I caught up with artist Michelle Reed about her current exhibition on her Artois Contemporary, A Biome of Hue. And I also caught up with senior curator of global contemporary art, Natasha Conlon, about Louise Bourgeois in private view on her Auckland Art Gallery, Toi o Tamaki. So what have you got?
I had a kōrero with artist Cindy Leong about her show, A Moment's Interlude, opening tonight at Public Records.
He aha, ofakara, we'd love to hear your thoughts on these pieces. So tuku patahi mai, you can text us on 5395-5355. Wai mai rane, or give us a call in the studio on 309-3879.
Also, after the show, kaua e ware ware e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki e nei kōrero anō hei pakihere roki roki maronga i te pai tuku tuku o Erirangi Poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these chats and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Let's get into the show.
Yes, darling, but is it art?
Michelle Reed is a Tamaki-based painter exploring the idea of atmospheres and gardening through a layered material language that incorporates oil paint, pencil, watercolour and even the use of a water blaster, allowing an index of material vocabulary and mark-making to arise, interweaving these explorative methods of mark-making with botanical imagery to create a kind of synthesis of material language that dances between representation and abstraction. Her current exhibition at Artois Contemporary, A Biome of Hue, continues Reed's exploration of atmospheres, shifting the gallery space into its own garden-like atmosphere that invites viewers to engage with the work in a slightly different way, installed through the lens of a garden, some paintings hung high, others low to the ground, and one even wrapping around the gallery wall, inviting viewers to encounter the paintings through this alternative embodied lens. I caught up with Michelle about the show and overall practice. Would you like to start off by introducing yourself and your overall practice a little bit?
Yeah, sure. My name's Michelle Reed. I'm a painter and I live in Tamaki Makaurau, out Riverhead, northwest Auckland. And I've been painting probably about 10 years and just recently opened this show at Artois.
Sweet. And I'd like to start off by speaking to the title of your current exhibition on at Artois Contemporary, A Biome of Hue, which I believe is a literary reference to Geoffrey Jerome Cohen's book Prismatic Ecology. Do you want to speak a bit more to the specific title as well as the influence this book has on your practice?
Yeah, sure. A Biome of Hue was this lovely line that was written into the introduction of the book. Actually, the book reference itself came from a footnote of a Tessa Laird piece of writing, which I was enjoying at the time. And in the book, it is organised by colour-themed essays. And within the introduction, it's describing the idea of a prismatic ecology, sort of referencing the idea of colour in association to the environment. Mm. And I've been really enjoying how the introduction starts by describing the origins of pigments of colour, that they come from natural environments, and the history of oil painting comes from so many lovely, you know, places around the world. The idea of the history of colour was also being sort of mapped alongside the idea of rivers which change with environmental conditions, and you can see quite forceful changes. They use the example of the Mississippi River and how it moves and how it kind of reforms with there was a lovely word, the fluvial kind of erosion and changes, where the water kind of moves and changes the environment. And when that happens, of course, things are stirred up and shifted around. And yeah, so the pigments in relation to this kind of changing river landscape is a really nice way for me to think about this kind of ongoing process of art making. The materiality has been something I'm really interested in, and it's been a really ongoing interest for me, probably to do with my sort of background in textiles, where I think about the origins of things and material.
Wonderful. Colour is such a, really interesting feel, because now there's all the synthetic colours, and then, but then when you actually, look into it, they've got this kind of long history linked to these pigments. Have you ever dabbled in making your own pigments and, more deeply exploring that relationship with colour?
Yeah, I have done I have dabbled in it. I think that's a really nice amount to describe what I've been doing. And I've played around with probably some of the more obvious ones when you're playing with especially organic style dyes like turmeric and onion skin and that kind of thing. I'm really interested in some of the, is it the mineral pigments, which of course are more earth-based and you know, maybe clay-based or that kind of thing. The process is not that clear for me yet. I haven't really figured out how to do it, but it's something I'm interested in. I think I would say on the back of that, I have also been really interested in exploring and refining some of my painting technical skills. So I tend to be a person who likes to have a lot of balls in the air. And some parts of that I've just sort of parked for now, knowing that it's still an interest and that I'm sort of referencing it and thinking about it, but it's one area, one avenue. Yeah, so there's a part of my idea around materiality is incorporating synthetics. I think I've shifted from feeling like it needs to be an organic only environment into being acceptable to have multiple types of media in my painting. That used to be a bit of a definition, but now I'm enjoying that sort of open space and letting things mix together. I think spaces of mixture is a really fascinating way to understand environment.
Yeah, lovely. And speaking of colour, this exhibition seems to be humming with this vibrant green colour that illuminates off the paintings, a colour that also hums throughout nature with many connotations. What drew you to delve into this use of green?
Oh, that's a great question. there's little moments around my garden where green really almost burns, like it's really bright, little bits of moss, little bits of like clusters of weeds, things that kind of pop up on the really ground surface level. And I really like how illuminating that is. There's sometimes like kind of an alarming sense to it, and I'm kind of interested in that, the way that sometimes colours can tip into alert, you know, or something slightly edgy. I think, that's an interesting kind of relationship with colour.
Yeah, it's crazy how there's, these colours in nature that seem like they shouldn't be this, like, natural colour, and they're, like, with green, it's, like, so piercingly vibrant.
Yeah.
Like, how does that even, like, come from?
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I think on a technical level, understanding greens, like any part of the colour palette, greens are a tricky colour actually, but they shift so subtly and we can read it so easily with our eyes, but understanding all the colour mixing to make tiny shifts in colour and to, you know, push something forward and push it, bring it forward and push it back, you know, in a painting sense, is a lovely thing to explore.
Yeah, and circulating the show is also this reference to gardening, which you briefly mentioned with the colour green, not just through the imagery itself, but you've also mentioned this connection to gardening in a metaphorical sense. What do you mean by this?
By that, I'm thinking of in an environmental sense, and this sort of tips into probably some of my earlier research where I sort of dipped into atmosphere aesthetics, the idea that atmospheres can be constructed. And of course, we're familiar with, you know, beautiful nature scenes, but I think it's also become quite normal that, you know, we become quite familiar with constructed atmospheres. And for me, that has been understood through textile and like clothes and garments, but of course architecture, in all kinds of design, to me it's like it's a some sense of constructive atmospheric making. I heard another recent term in a book I'm reading about imagologies or something, and this kind, I suppose in a sense maybe it links into world building. I've not sort of researched into that so much, but a sense of reality, I suppose, in some kind of selective way is what I think about. Yeah,
wonderful. This beautiful body of paintings within the exhibition display a beautiful dance between representation and its abstraction, building on these layers of material language through medium and gesture, incorporating multiple methods of mark making with oil paint, pencil, watercolour, and even the use of a water blaster. Do you want to speak a bit to these methods of mark making within your work?
Yeah, the nice thing that's been happening in this exhibition is I've been starting to think about the language of mark making more specifically for me. I suppose I feel like I've sampled quite a lot in recent years,
yeah.
And there's been something nice about sort of narrowing it down in a way, but
yeah.
You know, any kind of restriction I tend to feel too restricted about. So keeping it open, giving myself lots of ways to do things has been really useful. And so I like the variety. I like the idea that a pencil can feel like sketching and it can feel casual and that it's that there's a temporal kind of nature to it. The drawing relationship and, you know, I love like Paul Klee's kind of use of pencil and materiality kind of mixed in with his images. Yeah, and then I've been really enjoying, like I said earlier, just the idea of if the painting is some kind of biome or some kind of environment that it can all mix together. So I quite like seeing what happens when the watercolour slides over the pencil. Yeah, and, you know, what happens with those kind of layers and trying to get myself organised into what needs to go first and last and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I always feel like mark making and that language of painting, it's like you're building a vocabulary of marks or actions, and then you kind of use that, but then also by using all those different materials and mediums and methods, you're opening up for these little pockets of experimentation and for it to kind of surprise you and that response between the materials.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I really like thinking about how they come together. Maybe this is an underlying question for me, is something to do with the idea of composition. And I think that part I'm enjoying experimenting with, sort of multiple imagery references and how that comes together. Sometimes there's just accidental wins and sometimes there's just accidental losses with it. But the combination of that sort of mark making, layering kind of gives me this nice flexibility, but in the process of making it means that my paintings tend to go in different directions each time, which I really like.
So do you enter the making process with specific painting in mind, or do you go into it full kind of not blank, but in that kind of open to a kind of reception and not knowing that specific thing that's going to end up on that finished painting?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm sort of working in two ways with this kind of process at the moment. There is a style I've been using, which is literally layering images one on top of the other and playing with sort of flipping the canvas, the image, it's not a canvas, my timber panels. And that gives them this kind of all over or upside down kind of effect. With my figurative pieces, those ones tend to come to me more visually and I can imagine them. So that's been an interesting process to recognise that actually those ones are more defined and more imagined, and I can actually almost paint them as I imagine them.
And speaking of this relationship, I also wanted to touch a bit more on the specific imagery that surfaces within your work, this botanical garden imagery, as well as these gestural swirly line motifs that appear, these two different sets of imagery that really dissolve in and out of each other, creating wonderful synthesis within the works. How do you approach this dance between representation and its dissolution into these painterly mark making?
That's a lovely question. I really like making space for things to fail, and somehow that's been my answer to do it. I like it when I don't. It also perhaps alleviates some pressure on myself about perfecting something, and I find that quite reassuring that it's sort of an intentional mess, especially with the large swirly gestural marks, which have lately become more interesting to me. I'm starting to find there's a few ways I can use them, and I can see them becoming more.
Like almost like replacing an image in that sense with that gesture.
Yeah, yes, exactly. And likewise with the plants, with the kind of the idea, I think initially just kind of tipped over from some reading about multi-species. And I like the idea that, you know, I mean, it's like when I look at my cat and I think she looks like a seal and a large cat, but she's just tiny, and a possum and a lemur because she has a stripy tail. But there's all those like kind of multiple references, and I quite like the idea in the sense of change that there's sort of a multiple situational reference that sort of happens. And so I like to layer up the you know, what is the concept or sometimes the sticky thing that might need to change, and somehow that creates an abstract form out of it.
Yeah, beautiful. And I also noticed within the show and wanted to talk about this, the shift away from a typical install / modes of hanging. A typical painting show would have all the works hung at 150 and follow this line around the gallery. But you kind of completely disregard the so-called like rule with your install and hang your works at these alternative heights, even with a cascading trio of works and one work that actually wraps around the corner of the gallery wall. Why the shift away from the typical hang?
In the past, I've occasionally hung my works a little bit lower. For this one, we were thinking a lot about the sort of the reference to the garden and just being lower to the ground. So for the main wall, there's a diptych that we hung a bit lower, and then we're sort of playing with the idea of heights and just keeping it sort of just trying to keep it a bit loose, I suppose, how a garden can feel. With the lovely corner piece, same kind of thing. The idea with the corner has been really fascinating, and big thanks to Andrew Rankin, actually, who built the beautiful Totara frames for me. But that idea of going around the corner, you know, that plants don't define, or that they grow particularly in a crack or in a corner. That's quite fascinating to me, that those edges and the kind of off-center is considered too.
Like plants don't adhere to these straight corners and boundaries, and they weave and find their way into these cracks and crevices and
totally
kind of grow and
like all the little mosses that, you know, pop up at the side of like roads and curbs and stuff.
I also wanted to ask, as well as this install being kind of in reference to that garden and stuff, I wanted to ask how it alters the viewing experience of the work, and also what do you think it does for the works themselves being hung at these levels rather than if they were at that typical height?
That's interesting. I once had a tutor who suggested I try hanging things low and it might help, like, you feel it more from your tummy. And it's interesting. I don't know if that works wholly or not, but I went on in my earlier, like, postgrad research, I looked into the felt space, and there is something nice to me about this, you know, you can sort of, you know, think and feel that mind-body feel kind of triangle. I quite like the idea that maybe it does access sort of just a different sensory connection.
Yeah, it brings it more into the body, and maybe, I don't know, maybe demands more from the body or as a viewer, like instead of just being able to walk through and having them at your perfect eye level, it kind of forces you to engage with your body and crouch down and be at that level with it and have like a more decision to participate with it and engage with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I really enjoyed a collage, and just hearing you describe that, you know, I like thinking about the space around. I think that makes sense even for the white wall. I like feeling like it, you know, it could be activated rather than just, you know, ignored or just seeping into the background. I like that it might be sort of somehow present. Yeah.
And lastly, what are your overall hopes for viewers as they experience and engage with the show?
Oh my gosh, I hope they can read into it as they like, you know. Yeah, it's always nice to hear feedback and bits and pieces, but just to take from it what they like.
That was Michelle Reed speaking to me about her current exhibition at Artor Contemporary, A Biome of Hue, which is on until the 25th of October.
Oh, that's a good art.
We'll be right back.
Wow, we get along so well. I feel like I've known you my whole life.
I know, it's crazy. I'd love to see you again.
Sorry, I just have to ask. Your hoodie is so random. What is 95BFM?
Oh, I knew this was too good to be true.
What? Wait, where are you going?
No!
Show the world exactly who you are with our range of classic 95BFM merch. From the BSA slogan t-shirt to ringer tees and hoodies, get yours now at twotonesmerch.co.nz.
I believe in, like, the solar system. I believe in space. I really do believe in space.
Spaced Out. Josh Aoraki from Auckland Stardome Observatory and Planetarium talks everything spacey on Spaced Out. 4:40 every other Tuesday.
So, which way is it?
The other's way.
Sorry, which direction?
Just go the other's way.
Okay, so left, right?
Other's way. You can't go wrong.
Left, right, front or back, every direction is a good choice at the Others Way Festival. And your mates at 95BFM have tickets to give away. So stay tuned to Drive for your chance to win. Only if you have a B card though.
95BFM presents The Others Way, Saturday, November 29th. Tickets available now from Moshtix.
Various artists, so you can go to the opening for more than just the snacks.
Cindy Leong is a Tamaki-based painter whose practice probes abstraction as a medium for meditation. Driven by Eastern philosophy, the works cultivate a quality of stillness, inviting a quiet contemplation whereby time is paused for a moment of equanimity, enticing a reflection of the self and the surrounding forces of our environments that sit in tension and harmony with one another. For Leong, her art-making process is just as meditative as she intends the works to be received. Her solo exhibition and Moments Interlude opens tonight at Public Record. Each work taking the form of a diptych, Leong applies muted, monochromatic colours drawn from nature, combining oil with incense ash on linen to build these textural paintings. Her mark-making moves across the canvas unrestrained, in tension with the grid that holds the structure of their form. Ahead of the exhibition's opening, I had a kōrero with Cindy Leong about a Moments Interlude and her overall practice.
So I was born and raised in Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. I'm of Malaysian Chinese heritage. I came into art a lot later in my life. Just shy of 30, actually, I decided to enroll into Elam School of Fine Arts, which I'm still currently studying but finishing in 3 weeks. So I'm pretty excited about that. But yeah, I came into art through quite a scenic way. I always loved painting as a child, but I never thought about it as a viable career path, and worked in the corporate world for about 3 years. And through that journey, I kind of discovered that I really had this calling of doing something creative and visual. And long story short, I sort of had like a wake-up call where I was, sorry to get deep really quickly, but I was in hospital because doctors thought I had appendicitis, and then they operated on me and they didn't, and it wasn't appendicitis. For 3 days I was just there and they didn't know what was wrong, and I was basically faced with a lot of questions about, you know, what I was doing with my life, and I guess confronted with like how fragile life could be, and you know, how your health could suddenly take a turn. But luckily it ended up being just salmonella food poisoning. After that, I I told myself I wanted to do something that felt more meaningful to me, and I started freelancing in photography. And through that, I think I gained the confidence to pursue art. I moved to Japan, and being away from everything and everyone, I had a lot of questions just around, like, you know, who am I? I was in my late 20s, and I found that I was missing painting a lot. The following year, after lockdowns finished, I decided to take the leap and enroll into Elim. And yeah, that's how my art practice and art journey started. My art practice is rooted in abstraction, and I investigate how to use abstraction or abstract painting as a vehicle for my meditative practice. So going back to sort of my transformative years in 2018-2019, I participated in a Vipassana meditation course, which is a 10-day silent meditation, a retreat where you wake up at 4 a.m. Meditate for 10 hours a day. There's no talking, there's no eye contact. Yeah, like no cell phones, no reading or writing material, nothing. All you're left with is your mind. And it really left a profound impact on me. And I've thought about, how do I continue this meditation practice but through my painting? And yeah, so that's sort of my ongoing journey through abstraction, is how do I incorporate the teachings that I learned in Vipassana within my abstract painting practice. So my practice is rooted in repetition and mark making, and there's a lot of like studies of materiality. I mix oil paint with incense ash, which is a holistic sort of use of materials, as I also have an artwork where I have this rice paper scroll where I've burned marks in a subtractive manner with lit incense. So it's, you know, catching that ash and mixing it back into the oil paint. But yeah, the paintings that I'm currently working on, all over field paintings, which cover the entire canvas. And in a way, I'm hoping to evoke a feeling of calmness and introspection for both myself and the viewer. So for me when I'm making the work, and for the viewer when they're contemplating the work.
It's always so lovely to get insight into the beginnings of someone's art making practice, and I guess having insight into how deeply intertwined you are with your practice and reflections of the self is also so lovely to hear. I want to talk a little bit more about some of the ideas you touched on there. Mm-hmm. In your current exhibition at Public Record, A Moment's Interlude, you're continuing this exploration of repetition, layering, and mark making, and as you say, investigating abstraction as a vehicle for meditation. As a result, the works do cultivate this quality of stillness, inviting a quiet and reflective contemplation whereby time is paused for a moment of equanimity. You've said that your art making process is just as meditative for you as it is the works are received, or you hope them to be received. Can you talk me through a little bit what that kind of meditative process looks like exactly in that making process?
Yeah, definitely. So it looks like literally, you know, me standing in front of a canvas, putting paint to the canvas, and it's the slowing down and being still and focusing my attention on the point of contact that my painting tool makes to the canvas. So echoing the learnings from Vipassana, so they teach you in meditation, you know, your eyes are closed, you're focusing on your breath, so the sensation of the air going in and out of your nostrils, so the physical feeling of that, so you're trying to concentrate on that. And you might notice, you know, your mind starts drifting and thinking of other things. And when you have that awareness of catching your mind drifting, you bring your awareness back to the breath. So in my painting practice, I'm concentrating on the painting tool making contact with the canvas. And if I find my mind drifting and not concentrating on that moment, it's the practice of catching my mind drifting and then bringing it back to the paint, making contact with the canvas.
The works appear to have this really beautiful relationship between the embodiment of the self and one's surrounding environment, whereby you've placed these unrestrained, irregular and repetitive gestures created by the hand in tension with the environments we're immersed in, connecting this exchange to the struggle between and harmony of the primal Dionysian chaos and clarifying structure of the Apollonian order, for example. Talk to me a bit about how you see that relationship between the works and these tensions that in their exploration comment on life itself.
Yeah, so the very fluid, wild, unrestrained mark-making references the Dionysian primal chaotic energy, and then the works are held together in a way by a grid-like structure which references the Apollonian order. And I feel that it's this sort of like this dual energy of like these polar opposite things, which is much like life itself, you know. Yeah, it's a really interesting balancing of the two. There very much is a tension between how these two can coexist in harmony. And I think a lot of that is life itself, having that balance and harmony and figuring out how to exist with both these energies in life.
Mm. How to find structure within the chaos.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Or how to roughen up the routine in your life. Or I think it's really much having the balance of the two energies.
Mm, that's such a beautiful reflection. Also, each work in the show is taking the form of a diptych, which you've described as alone and portrait recall the human body, but when placed side by side, they stretch into a horizon. Are you able to speak a little to this choice of the diptych and how you see that format transforming the works?
Yeah, definitely. So the very first diptych I made was actually due to practical reasons. So in Elim, a lot of my crits, the feedback was, you know, to go larger, you know, bigger scale. And I basically wanted to create a painting which was as large as I could go. But due to, you know, transportation, I could only use a canvas that was big enough that was able to fit into my partner's car. So I just, I went with the maximum size that I could fit in my partner's car and then doubled it to create one larger painting. So it first started as a practical choice, but then during a crit, a student, James, mentioned how he read the work like an open book. Mm. And I found that really beautiful. And it then started a series on exploring the diptych form. And then I also thought about, you know, what I mentioned about how portraits recall the human body, and then side by side they shift our view into a landscape. And I felt that it really resonated with what I'm trying to communicate in my paintings as well, about nature and oneness and this, you know, yeah, the spiritual sort of elements of no self within Buddhism. Yeah, that's kind of how I came to the diptych.
Within your process, once you've made a mark on the canvas, it can't be altered or erased. How does that kind of sense of permanence inform your process?
So the permanence of the mark forces me to be more focused when I'm painting, because I can't erase it or paint over it. It requires a lot of mental training. Though in saying that, there obviously will be a lot of irregularities and imperfections within the marks. And within that, it teaches me the Buddhist tenet of acceptance, which is where I'm, you know, accepting a mark, whether it's, you know, too thick or large or just not the perfect mark. It's allowing me to accept what is and the imperfection of it, which I find really beautiful, as it shows my humanness and my mistakes and the irregularities of my hand. I also look at the mark making as documenting moments in time, so documenting each present moment, which is unique in a sense because it's a marrying of different variables such as my temperament, the movement of my hand onto the canvas, or the amount of paint that could be on the painting tool. There are so many different factors that come into play when I'm putting that mark onto the canvas.
I think that's really beautiful as well, to kind of relinquish that control and be like, you know, there's some things that I can change and there's some things that I can't, and to kind of be actively interacting with those ideas is, I think, really special. That was artist Cindy Leong speaking with me about her solo exhibition, A Moment's Interlude, currently on at Public Record. The exhibition opens officially tonight from 6 till 8 p.m., where the artists will also be in attendance. All are welcome.
Only positive critiques. Honest.
Various artists.
Stay with me, baby. You can stay with me and nobody would care. You can stay with me. You can stay with me and just pretend I'm not there. Like a sailor.
What's it all for?
Various artists.
Louise Bourgeois in Private View is a new exhibition currently on view at the Auckland Art Gallery Toyo Tamaki. Louise Bourgeois, born in 1911, was a French-American artist with a career spanning seven decades of her life, one of the great figures within modern art. She was best known for her large-scale sculptural works and installations, but also had a practice within drawing, painting, prints, and fabric work. Bourgeois' work often dealt with these psychologically charged themes of memory, family, the body, and the subconscious, commonly drawing from her own personal memories and childhood. Louise Bourgeois in Private View showcases work from a never public publicly exhibited before private collection. This intimate collection showcases works that span over 6 decades of her career, from early paintings to a closer look at her iconic spider series, her sculpture of hanging spiraled entangled limbs, the couple, to later fabric work made in the final years of her life. A beautiful and intimate showcase of Louise Bourgeois' work through time. I caught up with Senior Curator of Global Contemporary Art at the Auckland Art Gallery Toi o Tamaki, Natasha Conlon, about the show.
I thought we would start this conversation off by speaking a bit to Louise Bourgeois herself. For those who are not familiar with her life and practice, could you tell us a bit about her?
Well, Louise Bourgeois was a French-American artist. She grew up in France and lived there until 1938 when she met her husband, Robert Goldwater. And after a relatively short, in fact, courtship, she followed Robert to New York, where she resided for the remainder of her career. She had had art training in France and specifically in Paris when she went to the Lycée to study. Originally, it was with the intention of studying mathematics, but she turned to art and then studied in the ateliers of some reasonably prominent artists, for example, Léger, prominent cubist painter, and was intending at that point to establish her career in France. So it was really the catalyst of meeting Robert that meant she moved to America.
Mm-hmm.
Met him while she was working in a print shop, I believe, and he had come in and they hit it off and, yeah, there sparked a romance.
Wonderful. And Louise Bourgeois in private view opened the other week at the Auckland Art Gallery Toi o Tamaki, which is Aotearoa's New Zealand's first solo exhibition of Louise Bourgeois' work. And as well as being New Zealand's first solo viewing of her work, it is actually this specific collection's first public viewing. Could you speak a little bit about this particular collection of Bourgeois' work and why it hasn't been publicly shown before?
Well, it's a private collection belonging to a family, and like many people who collect art, it is really their quite personal journey, building a collection and designed for the home rather than for any other purpose, to live with the work and to establish a deeper relationship with that artist. And in fact, beginning in the early 90s, the collection grew from the husband and wife relationship and interest in Bourgeois' work, and really dates from the time that her work was being shown in Europe more regularly. Because before the retrospective that she held in 1982, she wasn't really well known outside of America even, in fact, even broadly in America.
Mm-hmm.
So she has this extraordinary history to the extent that she lived, you know, almost 10 decades. She lived till the age of 98.
Mm-hmm.
And 70 of those decades, she was a practicing artist. But it was really in the last 25 years that the majority of her work occurred and where her reputation was built, so from 1982 onwards. So which is why she has a slightly unusual status of being renowned as a contemporary artist for the period in which I work, rather than a modernist per se.
Yeah, and such a wonderful opportunity to have that collection shown here for the first time.
No, it really is. It's quite a special opportunity to see an artist grow through the eyes of another person. It's quite different from working with a museum collection, which has a different way of being developed. You really meditate on what that person was interested in. That doesn't become the subject of the show, but it's very interesting as well, and quite unusual to develop such a large collection of one artist's work for a home rather than, you know, any other purpose for storage or even, I don't know, we have many examples of investment collectors in New Zealand of that quantity, but internationally it's also unusual to live with this many works by an individual artist.
Yeah, and this exhibition showcases a wonderful array and evolution of Bourgeois' work that spans over six decades of her career, from early paintings to an intimate look at her iconic spider series, her sculpture of hanging metal entangled limbs, the couple, to later fabric work that she made in the final years of her life. Could you tell us a bit more about these extraordinary works on the show?
Yes, so the show is not a blockbuster by sort of museum definitions. In other words, it's not about spectacle and scale and the everything. Rather, focusing on the collection, it was really my intention to think about that intimate experience with an artist's work. And in fact, there was an analogy for me that I really wanted to point to between Louise herself and the early years in particular of her practice, which the collection does represent really impressive examples of, in which Louise was working in her home, in her apartment in Manhattan, in the spare room, on the rooftop, on her dining table, and someone who might also acquire these works and then in turn live with them in their bedroom, in their dining room, and maybe not their rooftop, but, you know, the rooms of their house. And that feeling of art made within the home, you know, you often don't think about it then residing in another home. And it's quite a fascinating translation to me, particularly between one woman's work and perhaps another woman's home. Also, Louise Bourgeois' work can be quite challenging, so it shows a collector that has quite a breadth of appetite for sculpture in particular, which is quite hard to house. Yeah. A little bit about the range of works. Louise Bourgeois, when she first moved to New York, was quite heavily involved in painting. She painted a lot, and yet her painting has been seldom seen because when she would have her first exhibition of sculpture, she really cast aside her life as a painter and said that, you know, she would not paint again, and she didn't. Until her very, very last decade, where she returned really more to ink and liquid mediums. And the relationship that's visible in the exhibition between those paintings and some of the themes really help open up what she was interested in that time. I'm talking about the 40s and 50s. So that's quite a special aspect of the exhibition, to have these paintings and the sculptures that she first exhibited in the late 40s, which Louise referred to as the personages because of their strongly anthropomorphic intention and shaping. And she also has, the collector has examples of two of her last series of exhibitions from the early 50s in that period of work. So that first room in the exhibition is really awash with works from those first two decades before Louise Bourgeois herself would take a break from art making, or at least art exhibiting, until 1962, where she came back into the foray as quite a different art maker. And the second room in the exhibition move to that period of her work.
Yeah, it's so wonderful having these works that span six decades in that same space, as a viewer being able to walk through her life in a way and kind of make those connections between her different work. Bourgeois' work also often deals with these psychologically charged themes of memory, family, the body, and the subconscious, commonly drawing from her own personal memories and childhood. Could you speak a bit to these themes within Bourgeois' practice and how they are explored materially throughout her work in the show?
Absolutely. So after that break, or if you like, recess from exhibition making in the late 50s, Bourgeois had been involved in quite an extensive period of psychoanalysis and was, you know, practically speaking, going through that process, but also became really interested in what psychoanalysis could offer in terms of human expression, especially around its formation of archetypes. Yeah. And so when she started to work with quite malleable materials in the 60s, they became, the forms became expressive tools for forming different versions of these archetypes, by which I mean not so much symbols of objects, but big ideas expressed in geometry that for her had a direct analogous expression in psychoanalytic feeling or sentiment. So, for example, the layers, which she came to first in the early 60s, she described that form, a spiral form and a trap form, expressing different kinds of extremity of human emotion and thought. Taking the spiral, for example, she talked about how a spiral form could act as a kind of enclosure, thinking about a shape like a snail's shell, where a snail can safely retreat into their home, but also be a place that is where you can get stuck in, right?
Mm. And
quite literally, snails, with snails, it represents a kind of vulnerability and a safety. And it's these sort of dualisms that she explores and believes in regarding humanity. So the spiral is quite a powerful example of that, which she returns to in her last decade with work like The Couple, which is composed of two spiral shapes, or almost tornadoes over the upper torso and head of the body. And they represent two humans who are either trapped or embraced by these spiral shapes, but also represent different kinds of fields of expression that are either joined or powerfully independent. And these archetypes she really sort of focuses on for the subsequent decades and the rest of her life, and it reaches a critical head in 1982, around the time of her retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, when she releases an article in Art Forum magazine called Child Abuse, where she talks about a key or a fundamental story of her childhood that she says she returned to again and again and again for its ability to affect her adult life, but also as a powerful episode in her critical upbringing that she returns to in her work again and again. So this is a story of her father's affair with her tutor, who was a live-in tutor and lived in the family home for a decade, during a period in which Louise Bourgeois was really at quite a sensitive and vulnerable time of her growth as a young woman into, if you like, her sexual adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
And in the exhibition, we include a short film which has Louise talking about this moment, and she narrates the story herself using slides and photographs from her family history. And it's partly an extraordinary story, not just for the facts of the events, but also for what Louise reads into it, and in turn how she analyses her work in relation to that narrative. So even with the spiral, for example, she talks about it really broadly in those almost metaphoric terms, but at the same time, she talks about the spiral representing a figure of her childhood, a memory of twisting the tapestries in order to wring water out of them, and the river behind the family house where she worked with her parents, who ran a tapestry repair business. But also, she says, when I make that spiral, it reminds me of my desire to wring the neck of Sadie, who's the name of the tutor. So one of the extraordinary things about Louise Bourgeois, I think, is just her capacity to think boundlessly about those desires and motivations, human motivations, which are composite in the human psyche. Not all of them are desires that we want to admit, like violence and sexual appetite. And, you know, she really goes to many, many different ranges of human thought.
Mm. And this is such a wonderful opportunity for Tamaki and Aotearoa, having works from such a pivotal artist on show here at the Auckland Art Gallery. What are your hopes for this exhibition and the influence it will have on the buzzing art community of Aotearoa?
Well, one really fantastic point about the show is that it's entirely free. So because of the cost of bringing an international artist to Aotearoa New Zealand, we would often have to put it a charge adjacent to it, which would really change the nature of the exhibition and change the way that our visitors use it. And my hope is that not only does an exhibition on a single artist allow our art-interested public to explore and meditate on that artistic journey and development, which was such a long and important one for the 20th century, but also to return at ease and according to whim, really, and see different aspects of the show in a less pressured way.
That was Senior Curator of Global Contemporary Art at the Auckland Art Gallery Toi o Tamaki, Natasha Conlon, speaking to me about Louise Bourgeois' In Private View, which is currently on at the Auckland Art Gallery until the 17th of May 2026. And note that this is a free exhibition, so go along and check it out. I would really recommend.
BFM.
Era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā.
That's all for us on Various Artists for today. Ngā mihi nui to everyone who spoke with us, Michelle Reid,
Cindy Leong,
and Natasha Conland.
Nei rā, hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana, thanks for tuning in.
And remember, you can listen back to all of today's pieces on 95BFM.com or check out our Instagram, 95BFM Various Artists for more.
Ka hoki mai mātou a te rā wiki. Next up is the Land of the Good Groove with Murray. My name is Sophia.
I'm Maya.
And that was Various Artists.
We'll catch you next week.
You're listening to 95BFM. Keep it on the B.
Ka kite.
That was a 95 BFM podcast. Support 95 BFM with a B card. Go to 95bfm.com/signup.